Hello and welcome to edition 382 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound.
On today's show, we'll be talking comedy, how to be funny and how to make a film about being funny, be funny too. Comedian James Mullinger, inspiration behind the new film The Comedian's Guide to Survival, will be here later.
We'll also be joined by Clive Oppenheimer. He's the volcanologist whose cinema legend, Werner Herzog, turned to in order to make the duo's new documentary, Into the Inferno, which looks at how volcanoes affect communities around the globe.
And we'll be hearing from musical pioneer, unconventional hitmaker, and now author, Carl Hyde. He's one half of the musical duo Underworld, and his new book, I Am Dog Boy, tells the story of how that band went overground.
That's all coming up in the next hour, plus Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan will be here with the news look ahead, and we'll enjoy some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly, and that's on Monocle 24.
It is on Monocle 24, Andrew. Welcome everybody to the programme. Wow, what a week it's been. Would you like to give people some small insights into the amount that we have gritted our teeth? Our fingers are maybe 2 inches shorter than they were at the beginning of the week from all the writing, editing, messing about we've done to get the December January issue out of the office. Well,
we have this kind of double whack of fun twice a year. This is the December January issue, which we've put together a beast of a thing. It's got a nice country survey, and it's got all sorts of things. And we've also been kind of simultaneously working on the forecast, which isn't far away. But, you know, the world of paper, we've also had two new guidebooks come in this week, which is Los Angeles and Copenhagen. But that means we've done 17 guidebooks in about 18 months.
I'm feeling a little bit tired. I went this morning. I feel like it's one of those things. You've got to go out and celebrate on a Friday night after you've pushed the ship you've launched the ship after you've cracked the champagne on its bows.
I know.
What did you do on Friday night, Andrew?
I was there joining in as well, and Josh was there as well. He loves an adult steamboat on a Friday evening, and he ordered a couple of those to get things going.
Should we invite our listeners to Google an adult, what an adult steamboat is, whether or not it is an expensable item?
Yeah, this is the funny story that he tried to get away with putting two adult steamboats on his expenses. Tom Reynolds, who's in charge of many things, but one of which is in charge of making sure that people are not too kind of willy-nilly with their
profligate
expenses.
Yeah.
He noticed this. And also he noticed that he had two adult steamboats at 3 o'clock in the morning.
And wondered if this was more willy and less nilly.
Yes. And anyway, he looked it up. It turned out it's a bowl of noodles in Singapore. Not so exciting after all. But ever since, everybody has been enchanted when Josh says, would you like to come and try my adult steamboat?
Talking of things puffing around the corner, should we welcome Henry Rhys Sheridan with his news look ahead?
Let's bring him in.
Henry, oh Henry, love the way you jump and rock.
All right.
Henry, oh Henry, love the way Texas hop.
But how am I doing now?
Everything is all right.
That's the second time I've heard Josh's adult steamboat discussed on air this week, bearing in mind it happened quite a while ago now. Or at least long enough ago that it's not what we would call a news peg in the Monocle 24 editorial meeting every morning.
Is it not?
Well, I like revealing these smaller sides. It's like when we discussed the other week your flatmate who'd been illegally wearing your training shoes. And by crunching down the heels.
Training shoes, my trainers.
Your trainers. What do you call them? Sport footwear? Or plimsoll? Do you call them a plimsoll?
I just call them my shoes. I erroneously refer to all footwear as shoes.
Do you think?
Yeah, I do.
Do you not like to be specific with things? I'll tell you what I hate, when people call coats jackets. That really gets my goat. And similarly...
Really?
Yeah.
That really...
It doesn't really annoy me. I mean, it's not as bad as, you know, Syria. But...
Yeah. Yeah.
That's okay.
On the 31st of October, a few things are happening. Number one, Halloween. Number two, Reformation Day in Germany.
Right.
Now, did you know that that is a public holiday in several German states?
I did know that, actually.
Did you?
Spent some time in Berlin, and obviously that's the epicenter of was the epicenter of most of it, and that's a good one. This is one of these things that maybe if we get divorced from Scotland, we'll have them back. We can have a Reformation Day. Let's just do it and get over and done with another bank holiday.
Another bank holiday, exactly.
Yeah.
Brilliant. And
yeah.
It's not just any Reformation Day. It is indeed the 500th anniversary of the Reformation.
So it's not the Reformation of Germany, as in the Reformation.
Oh, no, I'm talking about Protestant firebrand Martin Luther nailing his 95 Theses to the door of, well, I think which specific church it was is contested, but I've got Wittenberg Castle Church nailed down there.
Yeah.
And one thing that when I was researching it was flagged up was the fact that only since about the 1990s, and I think this goes in Britain too, has Halloween also been popular to celebrate, excuse me, I think popularised by American culture. So obviously that's happened in Germany as well. So now there's a little bit of a clash between the two. And I know that there's been a lot of consternation this year over what Halloween costumes people should wear. People have been touting Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton. There's also been an epidemic of clowns. Are you familiar with this?
Yeah, I'm over that clown story. I don't like clowns.
No, so am I. And also I think the political thing is a little bit odd. I propose that German citizens, in order to resolve this conflict, dress up as either Martin Luther or Pope Leo X, the Pope who Martin Luther was protesting against, and fuse the two festivals into one event.
Halloween's very highbrow around your neighbourhood.
Isn't it? that's excellent.
So on the 1st of November, and this is I'm interested to get Rob's insights on this. So artwork owned by David Bowie is going on display in New York ahead of a Sotheby's auction. It's a private art collection owned by Bowie. He was a prolific collector, apparently, but it's something which he kept almost entirely hidden from public view. Now nearly 300 works by artists including Damien Hirst, Henry Moore and Marcel Duchamp. Big hitters, Rob.
Even Duchamp, maybe.
On but anyway. That, him too, apparently, is listed here.
He's the
champ. Can we just point out that actually the guy who was in charge of part of that kind of, you know, sale, he was a guest on the show.
He's come in.
We know about that, Henry.
But I'm interested. Does because there's two kind of avenues of value here, right? There's the art, the fact that it's an art auction. You know, art is already like a very interesting commodity in terms of the way its value fluctuates. But then, is it also kind of memorabilia by virtue of it having been owned by a pop star?
Well, I guess there is a sort of, you have a patina of kind of coolness and interest because it was Bowie's collection. But what's interesting about this collection, as Andrew and I found out from interviewing this curator who has put this sale together, is that Bowie's collection was, he had Hirst and Moore and Big Name and Duchamp and things, Big Name artists. But actually, I felt if I were to try to read something into his collection, it was actually that he rather missed the UK, and he had a lot of, you know, he had some of sort of the London school of painters who were a little bit dowdy, a little bit 1950s. He'd been this chameleon, he'd been this megastar, he'd been all these things, so many people. But I think at heart there was a bloke from Beckenham, or a bloke from Bromley rather, who was kind of dealing with where he was from, and I thought it was rather in the telling of it as our Sotheby's friend was telling us, Andrew, and now having seen some of the works exhibited, and maybe we'll make a film about it. I think it'd be a good thing for Monocle.com. I found a wonderful humility and closeness and strange sort of Englishness about the collection, which was very unshowy, actually. So anyway, it's a good one. It'll be a wonderful sale, but I think a little more down home than people might expect of the megastar that was David Bowie.
I'll move on. That was interesting. That wrapped up very nicely.
Yeah, he did well, though, didn't
he? Yeah, it was good, wasn't it? And finally, I presume all week, British Sausage Week is taking place. The 19th annual British Sausage Week.
Okay.
The event promotes the British banger, with events taking place all around the country. The website is www.lovepork.co.uk.
Careful. Careful, boys and girls, when you Google that one.
Okay. Yeah? Now we should try and get Rob to talk in the same tone. He was talking about
the somber
Bowie about
inquiry.
A banger.
I didn't want to be somber about Bowie.
No, it was so eloquent. But
are you sausage fans, both of you? Or because I tell you, who does love a sausage and who frequently expounds his love of sausages? Tom Edwards, Monocle 24, producer and former news look aheader.
Well, that's because we have a pop up restaurant here every month, and when Herman the German came in with his
Verst,
his Verstwagen. Tom Edwards is out there in a shot.
Forget about it. I know. And he's always looking for a good butcher's. Expanding,
I think he had
the virtues of the pork sausage.
He's only ate too many. He was the worst for wear.
Hey! I don't think we can get... That's perfect, isn't it? That's pretty good.
Yes.
But if you want more details on the British Sausage Week, lovepork.com. www.reformation.co.uk.
from the German Reformation to pork. That's quite a nice little journey. Thank you for taking us along that nice greased up slide of sausage meat. Enjoyable.
My pleasure.
James Mullinger is a British comedian based in Canada. That's not the joke. And before we found fame making people laugh, he was a journalist. And he's learned his trade from some of the best, having interviewed and worked with everyone from Jerry Seinfeld to Russell Brand.
But now it's James's turn to be in the spotlight. His journey through the world of comedy has been made into a feature film, The Comedian's Guide to Survival, which is currently in a cinema near you. And he joins us to give us a crash course in how to be funny. Hopefully, Andrew, possibly. We'll see. James, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you very much. It's an honour to be here, genuinely.
We realise that, that's fine.
how short can we make this? I mean, I don't know. It says a crash course. What,
we should reveal slightly before this gets too rude that we do know James. We personally know you as well.
We've all been close friends for a long time. You and I we first met 15 years ago, and Rob and I met 30 years ago. So you're right. We should say that now before people listening think we sound a bit too familiar.
Rob's still telling people he's 27. Be careful what you reveal here.
So first thing first, congratulations
Thank
on
you.
The Comedian's Guide to Survival. What's it like when you see yourself on the big screen, when you see bits of stuff that you've kind of written down in your notebook that might be sort of food for a part of your stand-up routine, and you see it being performed by quite a big name comedian, you know, British comedian, on a cinema screen. That's good stuff.
Yeah, I should say. I mean, it's James Buckley from The Inbetweeners plays me, and he's not trying to emulate me, which was a very wise creative move, I believe, because we need the protagonist to be likable.
He needs a career too, right?
Yeah, exactly. He's got to work again. But what he did do was obviously he brought the kind of same kind of he's exaggerated, I think, exaggerated the kind of desperation and loneliness I felt at this time. But the weird thing was watching certain things be reenacted. Firstly, obviously, he's performing my stand-up, my actual stand-up, some of it from then, some of it from more recently, and I now obviously have to drop those jokes because they're now being kind of immortalized in a film where he gets booed off telling these jokes, so I can't do them. Most kind of meta were the scenes where we're in Montreal filming him playing me interviewing comedians who I interviewed, that same comedian, only 4 years prior in that same room. So that was a weird moment. But to me, I think the one that stood out the most was watching the scene where he sleeps on the train platform, which was something that happened to me regularly, but specifically there was a night where I slept on. And just to clarify, I mean, things weren't going that badly. I was missing trains, yeah. I would work all day at GQ and then go and do a gig somewhere and then miss the last train and overrun or whatever. And it happened so frequently, I was carrying a pillow around in my rucksack.
That's the cold side of the third encore, isn't it? When you really can't leave the auditorium. They don't want you to leave.
That's exactly what it was.
Because you haven't paid your bar bill.
It's not because it started late, because we were waiting for more than five people to show up, obviously. And seeing him in that situation, sleeping on a train platform, was weird, mainly because it doesn't feel like long ago to me, because it actually wasn't that long ago. I mean, we're talking, that incident probably happened a mere 6-7 years ago. And weirdly, I remember I used to lie on those situations whenever something diabolical happened, like I was sleeping in a photo booth or on a station platform or in a bush. I always used to think, well, this does suck, but at least it'll be a great story when I'm on Parky in 30 years. Like, I almost felt like the more bad things that happen to me, the more likely I am to make it. So what's weird is that just a mere 5-6 years ago, was thinking, oh, this will make a great story on Parky in 30 years. I didn't think in 5 years I'd be watching a well-known actor play me. But like I said, I guess the important point is he's not playing me. This isn't about me. It's about a desperate comedian, and it just happens to be my experiences.
I mean, let's bring it up to date then. Let's come to real life, because I remember you came on The Culture Show here on Monocle 24 at the end of last year, and you said the one thing you wanted to achieve in 2016 was to sell out the huge stadium in your new hometown of 2 years.
Yes.
So tell us about that, because when people, as you say, when people look you up after maybe watching this film, seeing the trailer on YouTube and kind of getting excited about it, people are going to look up and they're going to see lots of good reviews. They're going to see that you played large venues. So there is a little bit of fiddling of the truth, which is very much in your favour. So, but tell us about selling out that huge venue.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. I had never looked at it that way, but you're right. There is something quite nice about I hadn't even crossed my mind that people are going to have this kind of very low opinion. So even if the stand-up clips that are online are mediocre...
Is he that funny? Definitely a liar.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so I moved to St. John, New Brunswick 2 years ago, which is on the east coast of Canada, a beautiful city where my wife's from. And I would like to congratulate you on the Canada special of the new issue of Monocle, because there's a wonderful feature in there about Halifax, Nova Scotia, which is very near where I live. And by Canadian terms, it is very near. I'm actually going there next week. I've got three shows there. I go there a lot. And by very near, I mean
it's a
4-hour drive away. It's a 4-hour drive. But that
the plane
is very,
doesn't need to refuel. It's so close.
Exactly. Yeah. It's very, very... But what I loved about reading that is that, a lot of people forget and ignore about the East Coast in Canada. But my point is this. I've read Monocle since its inception, since the beginning. But I've never really known a great deal about the places I was reading about. So I thought, well, this sounds right. It sounds like they know what they're doing. It looks right. But this is the first time where I've known a place intrinsically. And I know this place inside out. And to read this piece...
Be careful,
let's not forget, it's a place that no one knows anything about. No one knows anything about. And I read it and I'm like,
get away with anything.
You can, and this is kind of the point. And I read it and I went, this is absolutely spot on. This absolutely, all the stuff about Halifax's North End, all about the growth there, all about the magazine newspaper that's thriving there, it was all absolutely spot on. So no one generally gets it right in Canada about the East Coast. So thank you for doing that from London.
Tell us about shipping your jokes with you across the Atlantic. Mm. How many of them survived the journey?
Almost none have survived till now, obviously just because of turnover of material. But when I first got there, I performed on my first night in Canada. And I was using stuff from here, which was a fairly relatable stuff, whether it be about, you know, sex or drinking or marriage or just observations. There's certain words that I was thrown by that I had to remove. Like, you know, when you talk about nicking something, they don't know what that means. It's, you know, jacking there would be the equivalent. So things like that that no one tells you. We all kind of know the obvious ones. But in a stand-up routine, if people have to stop and think for a second... You've blown it. But the answer is my material completely changed and evolved and grew, because suddenly I was in this absolute dream situation for a comedian. I was a fish out of water. So I go to this place where, you know, I can notice things. And noticing things is what we do. And that's all. So basically, I would say I wrote about a new hour and a half in my first 6 months there, and then took that to a big theatre there, which again, it was one of those things. Basically, when I moved to this small city, everyone said to me, "Oh, you can't do anything here. You know, nothing." You know, people were down on the place internally and externally. And I said, "What are you talking about? There's all these sophisticated people. There's people like you. There's people."
people always like that when you say there's sophisticated people and there's people like you.
Yeah, there's people like you. I found myself just trying to kind of convince people how great the place was they live. Anyway, to cut long story short and to bring it up to date, I did that show. It went very well. Did another one, and basically built a fan base big enough to sell out the arena a couple of months ago. And that literally just stemmed from what I deem to be just local business ethics, which is arrive somewhere, do a good job, and word will spread. And of course, that's the great thing about small cities is in a small community, I equate it to being a plumber. Like, people said to me, "Oh, there's no comedy here. Why are you coming?" And I said, "Yeah, but you wouldn't say to a plumber, 'There's no plumbers here. Don't come.' If there's no plumbers here, there's lots of toilets need unblocking. Well, if there's no comedy there,
this is too good an analogy.
It's perfect, right? Okay. So I'm going to come and unblock all these toilets.
Comedy toilet.
Yeah, and similarly, you can build it from there. It's a completely natural, organic approach. There is no when after the arena thing happened, I broke. I'm not boasting. This is a fact. I broke Seinfeld's comedy record at the venue, and everyone said, "How did you do it? What was the marketing scam?" Well, it wasn't. I spent next to nothing on advertising. It wasn't one specific thing. What it was word of mouth. I basically took every single thing that I was offered in the weeks leading up to it, every school opening, every you know, cutting a rope for a new hairdressing salon, and did jokes and basically just built it completely organically.
You spoke earlier on about being in the Comedy Store and being booed off, and you've spoken here about, you know, being in a large arena and people having an amazing night. It's a really fascinating thing how you know an audience is going to flow, and it's when you speak to actors, say, you know, they can play the same venue two nights in a row and it's a different atmosphere. You can play a matinee and an evening show and the kind of people who come is subtly different. You know, you never quite know what's going to happen, and I think that's the fascinating thing about comedy. It's even whether you go on a Wednesday night or a Friday night, yeah, the mood that people are in, how much they're drunk, well, they're and that's the thing when I watch people doing your career that I always fear if it was you doing it, just not knowing what they're after.
Yes, and that's a very good point. And of course, it's a huge part of it is looking inward and seeing what you're doing. I mean,
you have to be flexible. You have to be flexible, presumably knowing that I don't think these guys are going to go there. So I'll put that later in the set.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I have is some of my filthiest stuff I kind of have later in the set, and I basically have this gateway joke. So I'll do a joke, and if anyone in the room kind of goes ooh, then that's it. But actually, what I've now started to do is I actually say, right, you failed, you're not getting it. I was saving my best dirtiest routine for last, but you're not getting it. And depending on how loud they cheer, I give it to them. But I mean, exactly what you just said about actors in the same venue. Perfect example is I did a weekend at the Glee Club in Birmingham, which is one of the best clubs in the country. It was basically built by comedians. They refurbed it and got all the biggest headliners in so that comedians can't complain ceiling's too low or bar shouldn't be there. They said, fine, you design it. So the they got their biggest headliners.
Like to go into a building designed by comedians?
Trap doors, doors lead nowhere.
And buckets of glitter everywhere.
And so the stage is basically the right height. I mean, there's nothing you can complain about. So if you do well there, it's right. If you do badly, it's your fault. You can't blame the room. And I turned up there on a Friday night. Of course, I had a day job at the time, so I'd been there. I've been working for 5 days. I've rushed out of work, got the train to Birmingham. I'm exhausted. I'm tired. All the comedians, it's like their Monday morning, like they're waking up. They've just got out of bed for the first time in 5 days. And I am just shattered. And to cut long story short, I go out on the Friday night. I walk out on stage and it was just one of those magical nights. Like they laughed. They said I was doing 20 minutes. I basically only got halfway through my planned 20-minute set. Looked at my watch. I was on 22 minutes. That's how kind of plentiful the laughs were. It was magical. Walked out. I remember writing, and I found this recently in my diary that night in the Holiday Inn in Birmingham. I remember writing that this was the first time in my life I felt like I could play an arena, I could play a big room. Like I'd never felt so. I walked down Birmingham all Saturday feeling so electric, so alive. Went back Saturday night. Normally on the second day of a gig, I would turn up and walk in with my head down, kind of to the club manager and the security. Like, sorry about me, ruining everything. Whereas this time I kind of walked in, I'm like high fiving. I mean, they're not reciprocating, but I'm going in for one. And I just felt amazing. Like I was a proper comedian for the first time. And then same opener, same everything. It's 400 people again. Saturday night, MC introduces me. I walk out, and in the same way the Friday night audience had at one decided they liked me, this audience at one decided they hated me. And I made an ad lib, which was an ad lib I made the night before, and nothing. And to cut long story short, I got all the
you
way
got
through
your
catchphrase. I know I got all the way through my full 20 minutes and thought, I know that's not enough time, so I did three more bits, which normally take about 6 minutes. Walked off the stage. The MC said, "You've only been up for 14 minutes." And I mean, that's how bad it was. And of course, after the fact, I'm thinking, what was it? And I know exactly what it was. It was on the Friday night, I walked out on that stage with the right balance of vulnerability and confidence. It's like, oh, he seems nice, but he knows what he's doing. I think on the Saturday, I walked out with so much cockiness and arrogance that even if they didn't consciously think, we hate him, somewhere in the subconscious, I do a lot of keynote speeches and motivational stuff now about like, you know, body language. And it's interesting, we don't realize quite what a huge effect, and in a crucial situation like that, I use it in instances of business, or job interviews, or even asking someone out on a date. Like, I thought I was going out there with the right kind of like, I'll show them. But they all at once, 400 people all at once, despised what I was giving off.
And well, let's hope that a lot more than 400 people hate your work and go and see The Comedian's Guide to Survival. It's brilliant. And it's coming to a cinema near you now. I guess all the normal flannels, channels.
All the normal channels, yeah. And yeah, it's like the VOD and the BT and the Sky and all the stuff you've got going on here. And then the DVD. Okay. All the places.
Anything so, with an acronym and you're okay.
That iTunes thing as well, that's so big nowadays. They've got it.
James Bellinger. Thank you very much.
Thank you guys very much.
Thank you, James.
Appreciate it.
We'll be hearing from Carl Hyde at the end of the show. When he's not collaborating with the likes of Brian Eno, Hyde is one half of pioneering British duo Underworld. So let's hear a tune from them. This is from their most recent album this year. It's Underworld with I Exhale.
that was the sounds of Underworld and Carl Hyde there, who we'll be hearing from at the end of the show. That was I Exhale. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
Werner Herzog is a filmmaking master who, it's safe to say, picks his collaborators discerningly. His new documentary is Into the Inferno, and it's been made with the skill and expertise of volcanologist Clive Oppenheimer. We'll be hearing from Clive in just a moment, who, when not working with Herzog, is Professor of Volcanology at the University of Cambridge.
In the film, he and Herzog travel to six volcanoes around the globe, studying not only the craters themselves, but the societies who live in their shadows. These range from Indonesian tribes to Icelandic communities, and even a trip to North Korea. Rob spoke to Clive a little earlier, but before we hear that, let's hear from Werner Herzog about how he and Oppenheimer first met on the slopes of Antarctica's Mount Erebus.
What really impressed me was seeing these scientists toiling up the side of the volcano with such heavy loads. The temperature on this particular morning was minus 25 degrees Fahrenheit.
My face is frozen.
One of them stood out.
Despite having that fantastic lava lake down there, with all that energy, we still have to bring old petrol generators up to the crater rim.
Man versus Machine, Chapter 53. Professor Clive Oppenheimer.
On Erebus.
Hands in pockets. Waiting for it to start spontaneously.
I think I'll be waiting a long time.
Have you ever seen two men kiss on the top of Erebus before?
All right, going back in time there to the time that Werner Herzog and our guest Clive Oppenheimer first met on Mount Erebus in Antarctica. And Professor Oppenheimer is here. He's Professor of Volcanology at the University of Cambridge. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly, Clive.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations on a fantastic film, a perilously made film, possibly at times. One hopes a little bit, at least.
Well, some peril, but with managed peril in terms of the risks. I wanted to come back with an intact crew, and I certainly didn't want to go down in history as the man who robbed us of another, you know, many, many more films from Werner Herzog.
Indeed, exactly. I like the way you gave an account of that, almost as if I was like the man from the insurance company. No, it's all fine. It's all going to be fine. So first of all, Clive, I mean, it is such a specific branch of science. It is such a specific thing to study, and it is fascinating. It is about the world underneath our feet in so many ways. But is it also for you, is part of the attraction about some of that danger, about some of that kind of painterly danger?
I think it is. It's maybe more actually for me about being in the wilderness, being in the outdoors, and, you know, perhaps to some extent pitting myself against nature. I grew up fascinated with geology, grew up in London, and I loved the Geological Museum. I remember going there and seeing the gigantic crystals and the big gold nuggets. And so I went through that phase a lot of kids do of being into rocks and fossils, but it just never left me. And then after school, I had a gap year and traveled around Indonesia, which has lots and lots of volcanoes. And I think all of that kind of combined to forge my career in volcanology.
You go to and you talk about Indonesia in the film, and Werner, in his inimitable way with the voiceover, says this is the best place to be when if you're a volcanologist, because it has more active volcanoes than anywhere in the world. And you say it's a bit of a second home to you. There's a nice shot of you standing on the side of a hill. It almost looks like it could be Switzerland, only there's something bubbling away nastily in the background. So tell us about your love affair with Indonesia. Where did that start?
It started before I went up to university. I knew nothing about it, which was why I wanted to go there, actually. Mm. I suppose I'd heard of Borneo from some David Attenborough shows, but that was about it. So I spent quite a bit of time there, and I went back in successive years. And I think it was partly, actually, the way in Indonesia, which is a very populous country, but a very large country with an archipelago of thousands of islands. The people there are trading people, and they're always on the move. And you'll meet a guy with a bag of onions, and he's travelled on a boat for 2 days to get somewhere. He finds they've already got onions, so he goes and that was sort of what I was doing in a way. I didn't have a plan of where I was going to go, and I loved that freedom. And of course, I loved the volcanoes too.
And part and parcel of a lot of the places that you go to are the belief systems, the locals that live sort of on the apron of the volcano, as it were, and in the surrounding areas. And these bits of the film are fascinating when you, as a scientist, are asking village elders and local people what they think of the volcano, what spirits, the spirits with which they imbue them and all the rest of it. And I wondered whether you've learnt anything, whether any of that is useful to science or whether it is useful for anthropology, I wonder.
We always wanted to make a more anthropological movie than a scientific one. I mean, there's plenty of documentaries looking at monitoring and doom and gloom of volcanic catastrophes. So this was intentional to go out and speak to tribal elders and so on, and to understand their cosmologies. And it is, as a scientist, it's something that we do take seriously because, firstly, some of the oral traditions that societies living on volcanoes have tell us about past eruptions that we didn't know about scientifically. So there'll be a legend about a brave warrior who makes battle with the spirits of the underworld, and rocks get hurled in the air and there's a big hole in the ground afterwards. And then we find that there are rocks that relate to that legend. And the other reason is that if we want to protect populations on volcanoes from the threat they pose, we can't, as scientists, just waltz in and say, OK, our seismometer readings tell us it's time for you to evacuate. Mm-hmm. We need to understand their belief systems in order to communicate effectively. And I think in making the film, I mean, I knew all of that, but actually interviewing some of these chiefs on the different islands and the shamans, it really brought it home to me how if you don't have the benefit of a degree in geology, and yet you see this awe-inspiring phenomena in the crater, the boiling lava lake, you have to come up with some other way of interpreting and explaining it. And for me, that has equal validity as a truth as the scientific explanations. And I really was impressed how sincerely some of these interviewees explain the phenomena that they live with on a daily basis.
And do you think you have more or less wonder after interacting with these village elders and shaman and as you say, these local communities? Has it rubbed off on you, or has it made you more professorial, I wonder?
No, I think I come from a geography department, and one of the things about geography is it's everything. It's humanities, it's social sciences, it's physical sciences. So I've for a long time kind of recognised that there's more to the world than just fundamental
facts
science.
Facts and figures.
That's right. Exactly. But yeah, and certainly meeting these, the people who live on volcanoes, I mean, let's bear in mind it might be, there might be 1,000 years of tranquility between the catastrophes. So it's not just about these punctuated moments in time where the volcano goes off and people flee. It's also about people living, adapting themselves to the volcanic environments, using the resources that volcanoes provide. So, actually interacting with people who live on these mountains is something that's very important to me, very powerful and very informative, actually.
I mean, we heard at the top of the interview there, Clive, when the first time you met Werner Herzog on the side of Mount Erebus a decade or so ago, you obviously stayed in touch. How did it come to fruition to end up making a film together?
Yeah, we kind of fell in together on Erebus while he was shooting. I always marvel at the serendipity that we both arrived in this remote field camp 3,500 metres up in Antarctica, and that, you know, ultimately this film.
And you put your camera on him to begin with?
I did. I was helping to make a video installation at the time, so I had a camera. Okay. I'd never interviewed anyone in my life apart from maybe an undergraduate student, so I was a little bit nervous. But, we kind of give that as a bit of backstory to how we met. We stayed in touch over the years, and I'd wanted to make a volcano film for a while, and had pitched it here and there, but never got a real bite. And then about 5 years ago, I finished writing a book that looked at big eruptions in history and prehistory. And I sent a copy to Werner, and I wrote in it, okay, it's time to make a demented volcano movie. I thought carefully about how to pitch that. Demented seemed to be the right word. I heard...
Pull a boat up it or something.
I heard pretty soon afterwards. And so we got things in gear then. It took us a while to get the finances together and eventually 100% commission from Netflix, which gave us just, you know, all the resource we needed and the tremendous freedom to make the film that we wanted to make.
Did you see, you know, having been there for the shooting of the film, obviously taking part in large parts of the film, now it exists and it's an hour and 46 minutes. That's an interesting way of telling the truth. There's there is the 40 hours of truth and there's an hour and 46 minutes of truth. Is that an easy thing? Are you certain that the obvious and the best bits all have gone in?
Yeah, I think I understand.
And I mean that from a sort of aesthetic point of view rather than an idea about the objective truth. I mean, you know, there's a lot of bits that you go, oh, I love that bit. What a shame that didn't end up in it.
No, it did occur to me while we were shooting that you could have done something like Into the Abyss, where he was filming death row prisoners in the States, which had a feature-length film and a number of episodes on individual cases and prisoners, we could have done something like that. We could have had an individual episode on North Korea and so on.
Yeah, of course.
But no, I totally see how the edit has come about, and we discussed aspects of it. We knew it would be sort of in chapters, in episodes, because you couldn't mash up all of the volcanoes continuously. It would have to be somewhat country by country. It's bookended by some fabulous pyrotechnics. I've seen a lot of volcano documentaries and films. We really got some wonderful footage with drones and long lenses, and being in the right place at the right time. So there's some fabulous pyrotechnics that bookend the movie, but also some wonderful interviews with tribal chiefs in Vanuatu, and that as we were interviewing these people, they just said things. Oh, there's the beginning of the film. So I think that all those editorial choices really make sense to me. Even though there's some great stuff that doesn't make
it. It's still on the cutting room floor as we speak. I wonder, this is a very unscientific question, Clive, forgive me, but I wonder if you feel that you, when you have a happy band of people as a group of filmmakers, and when you set out with the right intention, whether you attract serendipity to you somehow, whether you get good interviews and you get some pretty amazing pyrotechnics which you can put Wagner over or whatever ends up in the film. Do you know what I mean? I wonder whether good vibes, there's a karmic element to all this as well.
No, absolutely. It definitely the case. I remember remarking to Werner, the luck that I had to make this film with him and to have met in Antarctica, and he immediately said, you earn your luck. And maybe there's some truth in that. But we were a happy band. He'd worked before many times with Peter Zeitlinger, cinematographer, and also with Paul Paragon on sound. And so there was a lot of friendship, a lot of laughs, a lot of laughter as we're making the film and hanging out in all of these exotic locations. So yeah, I think that probably does bring on some of the serendipity. And the other curious aspect of filmmaking, which I hadn't imagined, one of the most difficult parts of it is actually getting filming permits. So we had a plan to film in Eritrea. We had a plan to film in Hawaii. I wanted to film at Roden Crater in Arizona. And in all those cases, we didn't get the permits or the access we wanted. So we went to our plan B.
Volcano's feeling shy today.
That's well.
Imagine.
He's having a little snooze.
Yeah.
A lion.
Yeah.
But our plan B's, turned out better than the plan A's could ever have been. So in every case, serendipity stalked us.
Yeah, that's the way to do it, right? Yeah. That's all right. But just finally, everyone has a favourite view. They have a favourite glade in the woods. They have you must have a favourite volcano. It's a bit of a basic question, but what is it?
Well, it has to be the one where I met Werner, Erebus. Ah. I mean, not only for that encounter, but it's been the most scientifically rewarding volcano I've worked on. It's a volcano that is perpetually active, but not so threatening that you can't get right up to the crater rim and point your scientific instruments and get really, really detailed observations. So we've just seen amazing patterns of activity on the volcano that you couldn't do in most places. And the views are pretty good, actually, at nearly 4,000 metres up in Antarctica, across the Ross Sea.
If you can sort of get through the altitude sickness, I suppose, right?
No, we do. That's right. No, yeah. I'm pretty groggy for a week with headaches. It is high and dry. And then the other thing about the location is that it's also got all of the history. Scott and Shackleton, they had their bases on Ross Island that Erebus dominates, when they set out to their expeditions to the South Pole. So you're kind of very connected. It's only a bit over 100 years ago, but you're very aware of that scientific legacy that those pioneers left. So it's for many reasons, that's my favourite volcano. And I'll be back there in about a month.
Fantastic. Well, Clive Oppenheimer, thank you very much indeed. And Into the Inferno is on Netflix now.
You're listening to Born Slippy, the huge hit by Underworld, the British dance music duo whose unconventional songs have somehow penetrated pop's mainstream.
The duo, made up of producer Rick Smith and frontman Carl Hyde, have never stopped evolving since their original formation in the 1980s, and now that journey has been collected in a new book, I Am Dog Boy. It's a loose collection of stories, photography, lyrics and poetry gathered over 30 years of making music. Carl's worked with everyone from Brian Eno to Blondie's Debbie Harry, and even jammed at Prince's Paisley Park Studios. He joined our producer, Monocle's Tom Hall, a little earlier to talk him through the new book.
The book started off as a collection of the diary entries that I've been making every day on the internet for 16 years. So a photograph and something that I'd seen on, and written about on the street. And then as I started to collate all of this information, I realised there were these autobiographical moments that started to refer to very specific passions of mine: sound, radio, driving in my dad's car, coming from a backwater town in the middle of nowhere, on the outskirts of really nowhere, and all, how all of these things were important in forming my view of the world, both as a visual artist, because I went on to spend many years at art school, and as a musician, and how the minutiae of this nowhere place started to become my my palette that I would draw from.
You were kind of a musician jobbing in other bands as well, right? And there's some crazy kind of, you know, it's a name dropper's dream, actually, the book. I mean, there's some crazy stories. I mean, you were recording at like Paisley Park, is that right?
Yeah.
And there's that great story about you went to see James Brown with, because you were playing in Debbie Harry's band, and some guy was tapping you on the shoulder all the way through, and you're like, yeah, cool, man, I'll just like look around in a minute. And when you finally did, it was Carlos Santana.
Yeah.
I mean, you're obviously knocking around with some really interesting people. I mean, have you always seen music as, you know, if you can't make it as yourself, would you today still be jobbing as a you know, as a session guy or a player? Would you be happy to be doing
it? I love that. I love that, the challenges of playing other people's music. I love the challenges of whether it was a tour and someone says, we've got 30 songs, you've got to learn them by the end of next week, and facing this impossible task and then achieving it at the end. That was great. And or going into a studio, working with material that you wouldn't necessarily gravitate towards, but finding something in it that you could bring something special to. All of those challenges were fantastic. I loved all of them, and I'm eternally grateful to Debbie and Harry and Chris Stein for bringing me into their band and taking me on tour, and of course then taking me back to New York, where I plotted up for a while and wrote lyrics that became these sort of seminal works of Underworld in the early days. And had I not had those experiences, I'm not sure whether I would have actually let go of that desire to be in a pop rock group. You know, playing on the stage at Wembley Stadium for my dad and 70,000-odd people playing those incredible pop songs, that did it for me. That was like, okay, I've done it now. Now, what do you want to do, Rick?
And you talked about writing your lyrics there. I mean, your lyrics are quite unique in, you know, I wouldn't even know really how to begin to describe them, because they're almost, you know, collage-like is a really overused phrase, but it is these strange like excerpts of conversation. And I read that you kind of sometimes have sort of listened to just people talking on the tube and taking anecdotes and turning them into things. I mean, you're very famous for the absolutely unimpeachable refrain, lager, lager, lager. But even things like that, there's a real art to turning something like that into something that a crowd is going to embrace and sing along to.
But again, that was just something that was an honest reflection of how I felt when I heard Rick's music. I turned to the notebooks that I'd been working on that the night before, or the before that, walking the streets of Soho, and what jumped out of me was this bunch of words that seemed to relate to the music that he was playing me, and with no thought of making a chance. In fact, the truth is that the whole lager lager thing was, I got lost in the notebook, so I just kept saying the same word over and over again until I could find, it's the truth, until I could find out where I was. And then by that time I thought, oh, that's quite good, so I'll just do that some more.
It's like the Jeremy Paxman thing where he just couldn't think of anything to say, so he asked the same question 13 times.
Bit similar, only with a really good groove.
I wanted to talk. There's lyrics and there's poetry in the book and stuff, and there's a really great phrases in there. One of them I took was "Boats call to one another like lovesick bulls." That's a great totally summons up the sound. That kind of weird. That's in Sydney Harbour, I think.
I remember that. Yeah, going over Sydney Harbour Bridge at 6 a.m. in the fog. Yeah.
Yeah, and then there's really strange kind of anecdotal things like talking to the man who came to collect a drum kit whose life was saved by paramedics back in April as he lay twitching on the tarmac outside a North London rehearsal studio. I asked him, what went through your mind? He said that I was too young and I'd been shortchanged. I mean, tell me, how did that situation arise? I imagine that was quite a traumatic situation.
Yeah, well, do you know, people say amazing things, and that's what I learned at the end of the 80s, that I'd spent a lot of years trying to write an idea of the world, a pastiche of the world, when in actual fact there were these extraordinary stories everywhere around me, and all I had to do was just sit in a pub or a cafe or on a bus and listen. And it was Lou Reed that showed me that with his New York album, because for me that was someone singing conversational American, and I'd never heard anything like that before. So I just imagined how he might have done that and did my version of it. And what I discovered was that they were these fabulous stories that people could tell. And I come from a tradition of sitting around a campfire and people telling stories. Because I grew up in the woods in a forest amongst a bunch of hillbillies, basically, and we would sit around the campfire at night and we would tell stories, and that oral tradition was a very important part of my family's history. So again, for me, it was just going back to what I'd grown up with as normal, and yet had not fully grasped because it was so normal. I hadn't realised how useful it was. I think this, for me, the book is peppered with these incidents where the seemingly obvious route forward is I can't see it at all because I'm completely snowblind to it, and I just make these really bad decisions. And it's a catalogue of bad decisions.
Another thing I really liked was your description of watching Iggy Pop, and you said that he's always abandoned to the character of the onstage man, and you were saying how you kind of tried to adopt that thing of I guess like losing yourself a bit in shows.
Yeah.
I mean, underworld shows have like really incredible visuals and they're obviously well thought out things, but I mean, when you get on stage, is it much of it, you know, does all of that kind of go out the window? Is it open season? How do you kind of make your performances
work? Yeah, you have to
lose
it. You have to completely lose yourself to the moment and go where it wants to go. And throughout the 90s, it was all improvised, and there was a lot of finding myself in the rigging at the top of festival stages going, how the hell am I going to get down from here? You know, the adrenaline got me up here, but I'm not sure I'll get. So it was a very, very physical show, and I was very pleased that Iggy came to see us in New York at one point, and I think I did manage to get him to raise an eyebrow at the antics. But what was important for me was experiencing people like Iggy, whether it was Iggy or James Brown or Prince or any of those people that were absorbed into my memory and that would be regurgitated in fragments. So those dances that you see, they're just randomly reprocessed regurgitations of memories, of snapshots, of movements that I've seen people do. And what I was so struck by was the way that Iggy would transform from the civilian to the person on stage. And in talking to his band, I'd kind of say, you know, how is it to her? And they say, oh, fantastic. Particularly the drummer. He said, it's fantastic. Of course, it's amazing. You just have to be really careful because you're never not sure what's going to come over his shoulder.
Yeah, like a mic stand.
Yeah,
or
a guitar.
Yeah. And one thing about the tone of your book is, I mean, you seem quite humble about what you do. You seem to sort of recognise that you've been lucky to work with some amazing people, and you know, you don't seem too caught in that kind of artist bubble. I guess you seem quite human about what you do. There's definitely one or two sentences in there where you say, oh, I felt like it shouldn't have been me. I felt like kind of an imposter in say Debbie Harry's band and stuff like that. But I mean, obviously you are now that guy that people look up to as an artist and as a genuine artist. And, you know, you do collaborate on a same stage on, you know, with the same billing as Brian Eno and stuff like that. I mean, do you ever feel like you grow into the artist's shoes where you're like, no, I'm that guy now. I am the artist. Or are you always just trying to throw things at the wall?
No, every so often I still feel like an imposter. I still feel like someone's going to find me out. So sooner or later, I'm just holding the place for somebody who's gifted.
Yeah.
But having grown up with Brian's philosophy, it has to be about challenging yourself. It has to be about playing games that stop you becoming a pastiche of yourself. And I'm very grateful that we had that period in the 80s, because had we not have had that period in the 80s, then we might have been still locked into the notion of chasing an idea of what a group should be.
Yeah.
Or even of signing record deals in the early 90s when we started to have some classic success, and that would have killed us. So all of those negative experiences that I write about in the book, they do culminate in this fantastic partnership that I have with Rick, and that I realise that my favourite bands were those amalgams of very disparate characters that quite often made them split up,
yeah,
because they couldn't see that the beauty of what they had were their differences. I think, if anything, I'm fortunate to recognise that is what we do have, Rick and I, is we are quite different, but we cover a lot of bases for two guys.
Yeah, yeah. And coming back to that conversation about not being enthralled to record labels and doing your own thing and stuff like that, there is one chapter of the Underworld story. And this could be absolute myth. I didn't read it on the most reputable source, so do correct me. But is it right that you were talked out by the record label of calling one of your albums Tonight, Matthew, We Will Be Underworld?
No, it wasn't the record label. No, it was Rick.
just talked yourself out.
No, what happened was, it was an interview, I think it was an interview with Time Out, and I leaked it that we were going to call the third album Tonight, Matthew. Tonight, Matthew, I'm Going to Be Underworld.
Brilliant.
Which was a fantastic title. And then because they went and printed it, Rick thought we shouldn't call it that anymore. And it was just like, even to this day, I think, what was that about? It was a great title, and it ended up being called Boku Fish, it's all right. But, you know, there was a bit of a turning point there, because there were quite a few titles on that album that we allowed ourselves to be persuaded to change,
right,
by various people. We were always with a very cool label. Junior Boy Zone never pressured us into being anything but ourselves. We were very, very lucky to be with Junior Boy Zone, because they were always encouraging us to just do what we wanted to do, and they were happy to take that and do the best they could.
You are a multifaceted man. What do you have on
the horizon? I have an inside and an outside.
Indeed, yeah, that's true. What do you have on the horizon which you're kind of excited to be working on, or that you can give us a teaser of?
There are some things I can't really talk about that are very big projects at the moment, which will go global next year. And they cover a lot of areas of the arts.
Right,
they
okay.
do, actually. I wish I could, actually.
Massive and vague, my favourite kind of project.
Massive and vague, and I hope you like one of them. It's extraordinary, because you, being in Underworld, you have the opportunity to work with some amazing people that give you opportunities that you wouldn't think you would ever have when you're sitting in a dustbin in Bewdley in Worcestershire wondering what the world's all about. And I'm really thrilled that Rick and I are able to work together, but also to be able to work apart with such luminaries as we are at the moment, and have been for many years. It's an amazing band to be in, really, because every so often you get to be on stage and then you go off and do other stuff.
Well, we hope you go off and do many other different types of other stuff. Carl Hyde, thanks very much.
Thank you, man.
Carl Hyde of Underworld talking to Tom Hall there, and you're listening to The Monocle Weekly. Just the outro, Andrew, now. Episode 382, another one bites the dust.
Did Clive Oppenheimer have pointy ears? Volcanologist.
No, he did get... He did do a strange sort of secret handshake and did this sort of strange V sign, live long and prosper, he said. I didn't know what he meant.
No, I'm sorry not to... how amazing to be.
He was really interesting.
And to work with Werner Herzog.
And, yeah, and the whole thing's fascinating. The movie is beautiful as well. And it's got some of those classic Herzogian moments, you might say, of this just this wonderful found footage. Some of it shot, some of it old footage, but with beautiful music overlaid. We have volcanoes exploding as people kind of walk into the foreground with Wagner over the top and all the rest of it. It's pretty good stuff. It's amazing stuff. I'll tell you what also is good stuff. It's nice to welcome James Mullinder into the studio as a bona fide stand-up comedian with a bona fide sort of film career behind him. It's amazing, right?
It's kind of crazy how someone you've known for many years pops up and that someone's made a movie of his life. And he certainly looks well for being in Canada. He's someone who's hanging out in late night venues and I presume having to carouse with quite a few people.
Yeah.
It's done him good.
It has done him good.
Yeah.
Exactly. It goes to show that there is more to Canada than Moosehead beer.
Exactly. And he's championing the East Coast there, which you can read all about, as he said, in our Canada special, which is on newsstands now, with a very kind of quirky cover, which has got a Canada goose being put back together by a giant crane. It all makes sense when you read it, I promise.
It does. I think it's one of those covers you have to almost, you squint at it, then you look at it, then you squint at it again. And maybe on the second squint, all is revealed.
And then there's a little animal in the corner that turns out to be Justin Bieber. He says it on the cover.
I know. I was just waiting to hear the laughter from the listening millions here.
Yeah, I heard it.
Let's thank our friends behind the glass, Andrew. Today's show is produced by Tom Hall, and our studio managers were Claire Urban and Toby Hammond. The Monocle Weekly will be back again, same time, same place next week. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.